my reading resonates pretty much with what was said before, but I'll try to maybe add to all the perspectives that were already presented something that deals with this particular text on the background, on one hand, of Benjamin's other writing, on the background of his entire intellectual trajectory, and on the other hand, on the background of history, and first of all, of European intellectual history, history of philosophical and critical discourse in 20th century, and the wider history, of course. And I would like to start from like stating that, to my mind, the applying or attaching a term straying to Benjamin's effort, even presented by the diary which we are discussing, is a kind of ambiguous gesture, because to my mind it's probably not Benjamin who strays, but the entire time around him. It's a really kind of turbulent time, and for us it's almost impossible to imagine what was going on. In fact, the United States was straying in direction of Great Depression at that point. Germany was straying in direction of Nazism, and Russia was straying in direction of Stalin's cleansings. So it was a really tragic situation.
Можно я переведу? Сергей рассматривает эту формулу брождения или блуждания как метафору времени.
So in this context, what Benjamin does is probably providing us with a way of somehow maintaining certain orientation in this turmoil of like historical straying of the entire world. yet he's not as what was said before he's not in any way a kind of a dogmatic. he's in constant search, and of course what first attracts an attention while dealing with this text is his immense power of I don't know how to say it better, of subjecthood, I would call it. It's a feeling of responsibility towards society, history, history of humanity, and his ability to somehow track all sorts of processes in a kind of coordinated way. I can see the what is going on as a kind of incredibly complex symphony of actions and influences and causes and effects. On the other hand, he doesn't provide us with a kind of complete system. I would like to support what was said by previous speakers in stressing that it's precisely this kind of punctums separate enlightening moments what he collects, and within these moments, we can find the entire array of instruments, optical, what we can call optical devices, which have an incredible value for urban analysis and social analysis, among other things. Let's say we have roots or kind of predictions or sources which we find them developed in many analytical methodologies which developed in the course of the 20th century, like psychogeography, phenomenology as applied to urban environment, urban geography, and ethnomethodology, and up to things like actor network theory, which changes quite dramatically the traditional approach to analysis of society and of our everyday life. But to be short, I want to really focus on what, to my, in my impression, is the central kind of event of this document, and I called it a discovery of this double alienation, and I probably should explain what I mean, and this is not that easy, in fact. But my intuition of that is based on the fact that the beginning of 20th century was marked by an incredible rise of interest to, in relation to language and in wider sense sign systems and how they work and how they determine our relations in our everyday life. And yesterday when we discussed kind of preparationally what we are going to say, I remember that Wittgenstein's Tractatus was published in 1921, and that was a project of an ideal language, in a way, of a language which sort of coincides with reality or follows it as close as possible, a language of facts, language of actual proceedings, and not in this way it has completely separate itself from any kind of metaphysics. So it is a kind of service language, and it's very close to what our constructivists had in mind in their reforming architecture. On the other hand, there is a very similar hope for the possibility of sign language, expressed in Benjamin's own earlier and very influencing essay called A Task of the Translator. You probably know it. And it's a bit different perspective, but this hope for the historical possibility of an ideal language, a language which would redeem our relations, let's say, and our societies, it goes as a kind of red thread through this entire text. He says that this is the task of a translator, to dig through the actual content of a piece, of an object of translation, and find this ideal language behind it, which is not the language of the original, in fact. And in the end, he, and maybe paradoxically, maybe it's in tune with what Ksenia is saying, he resorts to the Holy Scripture as a kind of only example of an object of translation which has the same intention in relation to language which ideal translation should have originally. It's like ideally translatable text, and all other texts are far from that, in fact. I mean, I was just about to enter into the second phase, and the second phase is the discovery of this. So there is this first alienation in its alienation from the existing historical languages in their kind of corrupted state, in their inability to really manage relations between people. This is the discovery of the first alienation. The discovery of the second alienation, I think, happens in the course of his Moscow trip, or he gradually approaches it. But in a way, it's a summit of his thinking and a point of rupture, a crux. Is it the word crux? Sometimes I doubt that I use English correctly. And it's a crisis in the entire line of thinking. Crisis which also happened in Wittgenstein writing with his transition from Tractatus to his famous philosophical studies, where he already abandons his hope for ideal language. And I think the source of that, at least in part, what was happening in the young USSR at the time, because on one hand it was rebirthing, a kind of a world being born anew. All sorts of superstructures were ruined, and the society received a chance to start from scratch, from tabula rasa, and build everything according to most, reasonable and advanced rules and values. But what we see in the diary is a report about how actually this attempt is failing in front of our eyes. And this failure is not something that has to be attributed to anybody in particular. It's a failure of, even we can say, of a language itself to be reborn. So what Benjamin shows is the process how this superstructures reappear, and despite the fact that they're new and they're being built with good intentions, they acquire a quite similar function as those that were rejected by the revolution. And one example is his analysis of how a map of USSR or Russian Federation in diaries, Russian Federation in Moscow article is, I think it's USSR, but I don't know how it's in the original. Anyway, he sees these piles of maps being sold on the street, and simultaneously Dzigvertov's movie is being released called 1/6 Part of the World, and he kind of very penetratingly reconstructs the feeling of kind of eighth and somebody contemplates this map, the vastness of this territory in relation to Europe, for example. And he also analyzes all sorts of attitudes towards Europe and the same function of icon which is being adapted by the portrait of Lenin immediately after his death. And it's just a tiny part of what he analyzes. He actually analyzes the cultural field of evolving, very fastly developing cultural field of young socialist republic in terms of Adorno's theory of cultural industry. This is the most important feature. The author becomes a producer, a participator in a kind of industrial process, and any sense of autonomy anymore. And there's also this collectivization of culture presented, for example, by this Rabkore, workers' correspondents, who become a real power. And he actually describes the entire process as a permanent search for power. And everybody is participating in it. And there are all sorts of discussion on every corner, every day. There's thousands of conferences around Moscow, things like that. So, and he finds that he doesn't fit into this context. In fact, maybe because he's intellectual and he sees how it works, and that to be a part of it, you have to, in a way, lose yourself. And to be effective, an effective part of it, you have to kind of lose yourself completely and lose your, I don't know, calling as an intellectual. Use this distance. So this what I call a second phase of alienation, or second threshold he crosses. And the results we see in his father writing, I think from here, so we are trying to interpret his writing not only as rising some problems. First of all, he raises this problem of double alienation, but also as a suggestions of some ways out. And I think in his father writing, he in fact comes really close to suggesting something. And on one hand, it's his thesis on philosophy of history, which is, do you know it? Because what you've described as his experience of Moscow is precisely his concept of history. That
uh-huh. But maybe we should save it for further discussion.
Just two sentences. It's like there's no progress in traditional sense. He criticizes European social democratic tradition as being too much fascinated by this idea of progress. In fact, he says that real history always consists of particular events, and it's never homogeneous, it's never linear, but it consists of these flashes. And these flashes he kind of compares with what in Judaism, in Kabbalah, they call, there's this theory of tikkun, a gathering of pieces, which appeared after the vessels of God were broken, and they kind of penetrate the world, and they have to be collected at any moment.
Yes, I just wanted to add that for me, a permanent metaphor of Benjamin's visit was a fairy tale of Hans Christian Andersen, the Snow Queen, mm-hmm. with a broken mirror.
Shreds.
Yes. But Benjamin is Gerda, and Asya is Kai. And who in reality Gerda doesn't manage, and Kaya keeps keeping pieces together to compose the word eternity,
Which is also could be influenced by Kabbalah. Who knows? I mean, Leibniz was already influenced by Kabbalah in a way, and of course Schopenhauer and Spinoza. Not mentioning Spinoza.
Strange plots. Strange.
So the last thing I wanted to say is that another suggestion we can extract from this text is a suggestion of turning to architecture and environment. And for me, one of the most important statements I found in his entire writing is the passage with which he concludes his work of art in the age of industrial reproduction. And there he turns to architecture. First to architecture, then to cinema. And when he talks about architecture, he says quite... this thing is still not really kind of digested in our culture, I think, even including a Western culture. He says that architecture is not perceived in any kind of regular way, comparable to other arts, and it has... there is a very specific way of perception which corresponds to architecture. And it's, he says, it's in the same time optical and tactile. And another formula he uses is that architecture is being perceived through a habit, kind of day by day, by the body, by the movement, by performing certain rites. everyday rights. And this he sees as a source of, or as a sign of a kind of immense depth of architecture. Also, its historical depth. Why it never disappeared, why it was present already in the kind of like really remote ages, and it's still the same. And this, I think, is a proposition suggesting that we have to treat architecture and this work of managing the space in our immediate environment, an alternative stream in culture, alternative in relation to discourse, to logic, to theory, to what we are doing now. Yes, and that's for me a very, very, very valuable observation and conclusion.